Welcome back to the 76 Capital Sports Leadership Show. My name is Wayne Kimmel, managing partner of 76 Capital, the sports tech venture capital company. And on this show, I interview top sports entrepreneurs, athletes, and executives who are shaping and many times changing or have changed the sports business industry. Today, my guest is David Beckerman, the founder and of Starter, the incredible sportswear company that he built. And he's going to tell the whole story of that. And I'm so excited to have David on our show. David, welcome to the 76 Capital Sports Leadership Show.
Thank you, Wayne.
It's really exciting to have you on this show. I mean, you've done so many incredible things across the world of sports. And I think maybe we should even start the show off with, you know, how did we meet? You know, the mean streets of, you know, some beach somewhere. Is that how we originally
did in Nevis, in fact?
Well, it was great many years ago when we first met, and then, you know, just was so fortunate for almost every Christmas for almost 20 years we got to see each other.
Yep.
And you know, I learned, you know, a lot about your background, your history, and what you've done. I'd love for you to share with our audience here on our 76 Capital Sports Leadership Show, you know, where you grew up and kind of how you got to become the man who created Starter.
Well, I grew up in a reasonable tough neighborhood in New Haven, Connecticut. Athletics was part of the foundation, if you will. I played basketball in high school, a little bit in college. Not a bad offensive player, but not defensive, a little too slow. As a result of in the late 60s, playing slow pitch softball, just by a fluke, I noticed something. Some of the guys were complaining about a windbreaker that they had. It was interesting because they were paying high prices and buying the best uniforms or hats or gloves or shoes, but the nylon shell, which was an inexpensive piece of equipment at the time, they were complaining about. What they were complaining about was that it had an elastic cuff, and if you had a big wrist, it would cut the circulation off. If you had a small wrist, the air would go through. And one day I said, you know, that's easy to fix. Just put a knit cuff on it. Well, it wasn't available anywhere. And I had said, you know what, let me see if this thing could work. And I went to a local haberdashery store and I bought some materials and I went to a tailor and I said, can you make this coat with this pocket, with this collar and put on a knit cuff? And that was the genesis of a first product. What I didn't realize was it's a lot more than just the product. You know, there's distribution, there's manufacturing, there's a whole variety of things. And coming from the background that I had, from a financial point of view, that was way out of whack. Something that not only I couldn't afford, I didn't even know where to go. But I did. I had the product, and then I went around to sporting goods stores showing them, and every one of them liked it, really, and thought our pricing was good. I didn't even know how to price anything. What I did was I looked at all the competitors, and I took the high of one competitor, the low of the other competitor, and I just put a price on it in the middle. But what had happened was that they liked the product, but they said, David, we can't buy it. I said, why? They said, well, the problem is fill-ins. I said, what do you mean? Well, you know, being a little naive at that point, the way in the sporting goods business worked is that, you know, if you had a team and five kids graduated, you had to fill in the product for the team. And you couldn't have something that's different with a knit cuff, without a knit cuff. And the only way I got around that is I said to him, listen, if I offer you an exclusive within the area, would that help you in terms of your gross margin? They said, sure. And that was the beginning of it. So we, you know, I got all these orders, had no money, had no manufacturing facilities. And so now I went to family and friends to see if I could borrow some money. And that was very difficult to do based on the economics. And through a family friend, met someone, a man by the name of Ruby Vine, who owned a salvage store. I had a meeting with him. He said to me, asked me what I was willing to put into the venture. I said, I have $300 in the bank. I have a car, and I'm willing to sign on for everything. And as a result of that, he co-signed a note for me for $20,000. And
what year was that?
Oh, that was probably 1970.
And what was the name of the company at that point?
It was Starter. You know, people often ask me, well, how'd you come up with the name Starter? First of all, people tend to remember one word in terms of brands. If you think of the great brands, whether it be Coke or Armani or Polo or Ford. So, and I always wanted to be a starter. I never wanted to be a substitute.
I like that. I like that. Was the star part of it at the beginning?
No, it wasn't. There was a local fellow by the name of Billy Silverman of the Silverman Group I went to, and I said, listen, I want a logo that is going to be more than just on a piece of paper. I'm going to put it on clothing. It needs to be simple. It needs to be recognizable. He made me four or five designs. I studied it, and we came back and forth, and I selected one of the ones that he did.
I mean, the star, the Starter logo, certainly one of the most iconic and certainly innovative brand creations that have ever been out there.
Well, it certainly was a business starting from zero and ultimately getting over $700 million. It was nuts. But you know, I learned something along the way, something my dad always taught me, which is never to burn a bridge. You never know who can help you. And after I was able to secure the $20,000 note, I had to give him a third of the company as a result of that transaction. I decided to be on my way, and I started going and selling the product. And I'm jumping forward. Between 1971 and 1973, we became an institutional house where we made red, blue, green jackets, and I put logos on them of the local sporting goods operations or companies or whatnot. Now you ask me, how did I get a manufacturing? I went to the Yellow Pages, and after a series of going through a variety of manufacturers who did not meet the quality statement or anything else and all sorts of mistakes, I stumbled on one, and it was very, very helpful. You have to understand that in the garment business that we were in, you booked and manufactured 90 to 120 days prior to the delivery date. So that was an advantage. Through a fluke, most of our orders were 10, 15, 20 pieces. And one day I was getting an order for 200, and it was great. Then I get another 200 from the same customer out of Boston. And I said, I have to go up and see this fellow. And what it was a company called Twins Enterprises, who was literally 20 feet from the entrance of Fenway Park. And he was taking our navy jacket with red and white trim and putting a Red Sox logo on it. And apparently because of his location and relationship with the Red Sox, that was okay. But I said, you know, I can't be part of anything that could be illegal. And he assured me it wasn't. Henry and Arthur, they were twins, and they were really wonderful people, and his son, Bobby. And what I ended up doing, I'm saying, there's got to be fans all over the country like this stuff. So I went to, at that time, baseball wasn't even represented by itself. They were represented by License Corporation of America. And I went there and I said, listen, I have this idea. And they said, you want to do licensed jackets for adults? Are you sure? Because this is a kid's business. And I said, yeah. And they said to me, they almost tried to talk me out of it. But they said, look, if you're willing to put up $25,000 as a minimum guarantee over the next 3 years, we'll give you a license. which meant that I had to, whether I sold one or 1,000 coats in the 3-year period, I had a guarantee $25,000. That was in 1973. Considering I only did about $150,000 worth of sales, putting up $25,000 or guaranteeing with a signature was quite a risk. But obviously the risk had great rewards. And we began from there. And when you get a license, which we did, it meant that you had all of the teams, their colors and their logos. And this is key to the real catalyst of the future. We were now official. In other words, we had an official license. So we started making coats in our quality. We were clear. There were two other people, Felco, and there was another fellow. I just don't know. Can't recall what it is. We were 25 to 30% higher than everybody else because of our quality. I felt that that was something that was important. Later on, in never knowing what my dad said, never knowing who can help you, in walks Tony Amendola, may he rest in peace. Tony Amendola was a truck driver, and he would deliver raw materials to us. And his language was quite questionable. And he would deliver materials. And one day he said, David, would you help me with the church? And I said, what do you want? He says, I need some coats. So I gave him a dozen coats that he asked for. And I don't know, 4 or 5 weeks later, he came back and he asked me again. And I said, fine. And he says, you know, I know a lot of people in baseball. I can help you. Okay, Tony. And he comes back.
And this was Tony the truck driver, right?
Yes, Tony the truck driver, who's, as I said, his English was quite foul. every other word began with something that I can't say over the line, over the air here. Any event, one day he comes and he says, David, can I get a check? Would you give some money to the church? And I said, Tony, look. I'll be glad to help you. He says, well, sister wants to come see you. I said, look, Tom, I got rabbis, I got priests, I got different people calling on me. I don't need to have a sister come. He says, no. I said, look, I'll give you a check, which I did. And again, he reiterated that he could help me in baseball, but I had no idea whether he could. Later on, I found out that on his vacation every year, which he had 4 or 5 weeks vacation, he used to drive a truck for, I believe it was Anirondack Bat, which is the wooden bat manufacturer that many of the pros used down at spring training. Well, jump forward, I'm now at a trade show. I have a booth that's maybe 8x10 with a table and a little rack, and I'm dwarfed by shoe companies and everybody else, and I'm hoping that I'm going to get people to come into the booth. And all of a sudden, I see this crowd of people, and 3 men are walking towards us. And I hear this voice that I recognize, and I can't believe it's Tony. And on his left is Billy Martin, who was the manager of the Yankees, and on the right was Joe Torre. And Martin went off, and Tony yelled at him some racial remark to him, and they laughed. Joe had come in to... come forward. He came into our booth, and of course people are following him. They think I have a celebrity and everything else. And he wanted to thank me for helping Tony, who was a family friend, and also for supporting his sister. And I didn't know what he was referring to. The sister he was talking about was the nun at the church. And I was flabbergasted, and Joe said, is there anything I can do for you? And I saw kind of quick on my feet, and I said, sure, can you and your staff wear some coats? And I made coats for them and, you know, had their name put in and did customize as much as I could. And if you remember, Joe used to had his foot up on a step and cross his arms like this. Well, we had our logo on the sleeve, and all of a sudden I'm on television. A little company getting exposure. few weeks later.
And he was the manager of the
New York Mets.
The Mets, right. Yeah.
And a few weeks later, Joe called me and he said, look, would you like to meet Chuck Tanner, who's the manager of Pittsburgh, who's coming in? And I ran to New York and we did that. And one thing led to another because of our quality. We were separating ourselves from the official category. And we were beginning to become and create a new category that none of the leagues had even recognized, which was we were now authentic. And what makes it authentic? If the pros wear it or use it, you become authentic. And that was the genesis and the beginning of how it grew. And then I realized that this was a business far beyond what I thought it could be. And then I went to the first place I went after baseball was I went to football. And because football had something where, from an outward perspective, most of your business is done in the fourth quarter because it's back to school, World Series, beginning of sports, and a thing called Super Bowl. So, and Christmas, all that tied in. But I got turned down. They wouldn't give me a reason at the time. I subsequently called and I went to the other leagues and I was able to build licenses with the other people. I called in the NFL for 8 years, four times a year. And I found out subsequently much later that they had an arrangement with Sears at the time. And I guess they were happy with them, but they were missing so many other retail channels. Eventually, because of fluke, I would bring coffee to the receptionist trying to get inside the NFL. Bumped into a fellow in the driveway, in the elevator, and said, where's my coffee? And you know, trying to be cute, as John normally was. And I said, if you get me inside, I'll get you all the coffee you want. Later on, I get a phone call from the fellow that I've been trying to see for 8 years. And it indicated to me that there was a chance to come, and there was an opportunity. There was some a financial structure that I had to meet and whatnot. And I said, fine. And I was so excited that I called the fellow that I bumped into who had given me his business card, thinking that he had was responsible. I called him and I thanked him, and he said he wasn't aware of what was going on. And he says, I'll call you back. And he then called me and he said, look, can you come in next week? And I said, yeah, which I did. And we got a license, and that gave me something that no one had, which was now I had baseball, basketball, football, hockey, and I was one-stop shopping. So when you go into a retail store, if you're more attuned to the hockey end of it, I could sell it to you. And we were off and running from there.
You got all the four major teams, again, four major leagues, as you said, the NBA, Major League Baseball, the NFL, the NHL, and you created these iconic satin jackets that the pros wore, whether it was the managers, the players. And how did you balance this item that people were aspiring to want to have, to also not making it just like this mass market product? To kind of, how do you balance that?
Well, number one, our distribution, I wouldn't sell. When you say mass, there are a certain level of retail that we would not sell. We felt that our product should be at the mid to an upper level in our distribution. Meant that we would sell a Foot Locker or we would sell a Champs, but we wouldn't sell Walmart at the top. Okay.
Right.
So that was number one. Number two, as I said, the genesis, the beginning was we were now becoming known as the authentic house. Wear what the pros wear. The real key here of this business, what it was understanding the bond and the emotional tie between the individual and the sport and the player or the school. Think about the allegiance that individuals have to their school or to their team or their college program. And that was something that we recognized right away. And we surrounded it with what I always called was common sense. We developed focus groups. Those focus groups were made up of high school kids. They understood what was going on, not with sports only, but with things with music. Some of the leagues had what the hell I was doing, but the music industry was really an underground kind of foundation, and clearly the inner city, who has a love of music, also was a catalyst to fashion. And things began to become very obvious with the hookup. Now, what's a hookup? You get a kid who all of a sudden buys red sneakers. He buys a red hat. And he may be going to the University of Maryland, but he wants a red jacket. And just because it said Houston Rockets on it, had no bearing on it because he had a red hat, a red jacket, and red shoes. So the hookup, and it started the mushroom. I mean, it really, really started the mushroom to a point where some of our business philosophy got challenged.
Were there certain influencers over the years, whether it was an athlete or a musician?
Oh, sure.
Really important.
I can give you, I remember us talking to Spike Lee, for example, at the Knick game. You know, he obviously is a devout Knick fan, and he wore a Knick hat. I don't remember exactly. It was a blue hat, obviously. And he then, well, you got anything else? Do you have an orange one or a white one? And we made a whole bunch of different color hats for him. And again, you know, we're a society that's almost boo crazy. He goes to sits on the front line and he's wearing a different color hat or a different color jacket. And indirectly at that time, he was an influencer. Or you had a fellow by the name of Funk Master Flex, who was one of the first DJs, terrific fellow, who we made clothes for. Now he, you know, he gets exposure and he's sending his vibes out for music. All of a sudden, you know, we have a movie called Coming to America, where Eddie Murphy is in it, and we turned around and made sure that our product was there, or Kevin Costner in The Love of the Game, where all of a sudden the logo was identified not only with sports, but with everyday life or with a focused direction. And I always felt that focused direction was important to building a company, but more importantly, is building our identity. And we became a lifestyle brand. I mean, it really was something.
How did you come up with the idea of putting the hat and the jerseys on championship teams and players?
Well, here's what happened. It's really a question of, and I'm not trying to be modest, it's really a question of survival. What does that mean? We had a t-shirt license. There had to be 15 other guys that had t-shirt licenses. And the league always created an exclusive on a design only, but not on a product, meaning that you had a t-shirt license, I had a t-shirt license. If I made a design that was a circle and you made a square, I couldn't do a square and you couldn't do a circle using those analogies. So we had to separate ourselves. I remember going to the Boston Celtics at the time, meeting Red Auerbach, and he knew that I had coached the Maccabiah team in 1979. And he was terrific. And then there was a fellow by the name of Billy Marshall who used to work in Boston, and then the NBA hired him. And we were coming up with different designs. And then I had a crazy thought. I said, listen, how about after you win the championship, I give you, you know, you get a hat and a t-shirt, whatever, and you wear it. And obviously, you can't charge them. It's free. And we did that. Well, we believe what we see. And, you know, our children do what they see, not what they hear. You know, I've always believed that in a family direction. And all of a sudden in 86, after the Celtics had beaten the Lakers, Kevin McHale is holding up the shirt, and all of a sudden everybody's putting it on it. Now that design separated us from everybody else. And all of a sudden the kids want that shirt. You know, it's...
And wasn't that the design with all the faces on the shirt?
No. That one, the first one that was done was at number one, and it had all the years that the Celtics had won.
Okay.
The one with the faces came on later on. So, and, you know, that spread. We did it in every single sport. So, you know, Starter invented that. I did, whatever. And it's come synonymous now with winning championships.
What about Emmitt Smith and wearing?
Emmitt Smith is an interesting story. My son Brad, who's a decent high school player, always wanted to go to University of Florida. And from an athletic point of view, it was a reach at that level. But in any event, he goes, he makes the team, and he was on the team. And then the following year, we had a manufacturing facility in Pensacola, Florida. And I had said to Brad, there's a young, one of the our employees had indicated to me that when I took my visits that I believe it was either the son, her son or her nephew, I can't recall which, is going to the University of Florida. You know, and I said, tell me his name. And I called Brad and I said, Brad, there's a young guy. I'd like you to take him to lunch. It's one of our employees' relationships. He said, fine, who is it? And I, at that time, no name, no one knew it, but it was Emmitt Smith. And Emmitt and Brad had a relationship in the next few years, and he was great. He wore a hat for us after they won a Super Bowl. I can't tell you how many spider hats we sold. Over a million. It was wild. And Brad, as I said, I think he was in his wedding as well. But again, you just never know who can help you. And you don't burn bridges.